Okay, well, first, thank you very much for inviting us to come and talk to you all. I think the previous presentation was a great example as to why it's wonderful to as a policymaker to have the opportunity to come and interact with all of you at your meetings this week. I'm with the Office of Water at EPA, and I'm in the Nonpoint Source Program, so Section 319, if you've worked with any of those projects in the past. That's kind of where I sit, and I focus on agricultural water quality issues in the Office of Water. And so why is this on the agenda? Why was EPA invited here to come and speak with you all? Sorry, let me get this moved over here. First and foremost, the U.S., we've made great strides in reducing pollutants over the last 37, 38, 40 years. Many, many different things added to that, and we are continuing to control pollution specifically and very well from industrial sources as well as sewage treatment plants, and those are point sources. Where we are seeing slower progress is from the non-point sources. We simply have not done enough to control the pollution from non-point sources. We know from a lot of data that I'm going to show some of it here today that non-point source is the leading cause of water quality impairments in the country and perhaps worldwide. And it's mainly the reason that approximately 52% of the surveyed rivers, lakes, and streams in this country by the states are not clean enough to meet simple necessary uses such as swimming, drinking, fishing, etc. And ag is the number one, is the leading non-point source contributor. It's the biggest non-point source that we see nationally. And part of why I'm here is because I would like to make the plea that we need your help. As it was stated in the past two presentations, we need the best tools, and we need to understand how to get those best tools on the ground as fast as we can to make some inroads here. A lot of what we're talking about at EPA and across the federal government right now through some of the intergovernmental actions that we're doing is this system of accountability. How do we build a new system of accountability into the structure that we have right now? And that's a big question. And I think it's very important for all those involved in the agricultural community to have a say in that and to be involved. And again, I'm just happy to be here to talk with you all. Some of the pressures that we're feeling, you wouldn't read necessarily all of these as pressures, and I know throughout the room you can't see these, so I guess I'll note some of them. We've seen a major investment in research and science for non-point source pollution from agriculture and what needs to happen. And we have a lot of that information. And like was mentioned just 10 minutes ago, we have a lot of data sets that are going to help us guide the way. Are they being put to use? Are the policy makers really able to access them and use them to the way that the scientists would hope? We have that investment currently. There's a substantial commitment to the development of guidance, technical assistance, on-the-ground work, and information transfer. I don't think I know of anything that is as clear as that nano hub. That looks really cool. What can we do for nutrient management? Is that the right tool, kind of tool that we need? That could bring some of these things that we have already. There's a number of state and local conservation practice pilots nationwide. We see a lot of funding goes to those kinds of things, but the next big question is how do you move those small pilots where we're seeing real results into the larger framework? Continued state innovation testing, exploration of many different kinds of programs across the board we've been looking at over the last, I'd say 20 years closely. One of the biggest barriers that we have to a general framework for nutrient management per se would be just all the different oversights, all the different regulations that one would have to deal with. Be you a state person, be you a farmer, be you a producer, be you an ecologist. There are just a massive number of state and federal, local regulatory oversight, and we recognize that. So, some of the next steps, the larger context here, the bottom line is, while EPA and while you all here participating in this symposium are concerned, there is a significant number of others that are concerned as well. We are currently dealing with, this is just a small list of litigation and petitions that are forcing us to answer these questions quickly. And we have to rely on the current information that we have right now. Recently, there was a Chesapeake Bay executive order come down from the president that enforces the across federal agencies to work together, develop this system of accountability, develop something new that can move us forward to see reductions to the Chesapeake Bay. That's just one example. Why not do that nationally? There's a EPA Inspector General report that said just recently that we're not doing enough to get nutrient water quality standards on the ground implemented. What's our response? We'll be responding to that actually later on this, it's November, later on this month. And just recently we released the state EPA Nutrient Innovation Task Group report, and I'm going to incorporate some of the information into this to kind of talk to you about where we are with that. The states and EPA came together over the last 6 months and developed a call to action, synthesized much of the information that's been out there, tried to compile it in one place for the policymakers, and EPA and the states co-submitted it to the administrator of the EPA, and we're working to move forward to see what we can do. The biggest takeaway from the Chesapeake Bay report is this next generation of tools and actions. What does that mean? That's what we're called upon to develop. And there's 5 federal agencies involved in this, 6 states working to develop what those next generation tools are and figure out a way to make sure that they are all on the ground and implemented by 2025. Existing data analysis. These are some of the sources of information that we've pulled from. This is a select list. I see a few of you in the audience here who have participated on some of this information development and research, so I'm not going to go over it. But the big thing here is that bottom one, the numerous published articles, state reports, university studies. This is where you, the scientific community in general, comes in, and we do read your reports and references and try to figure out ways to gather information. I'm interested in learning about this INSPIRE program at Washington State. I'm sure they would have some things they could tell us. So to get into some of the specific data sets that we've looked at, in 2006, we came out with the weightable stream survey results. So all of these points here were locations identified where it was a weightable stream and nutrient concentrations were measured on a statistical survey basis. You see some hot spots come to light, mainly down there in Southern California, and what's that coming from? That's mainly POTWs. That would be sewage treatment sources. You see there in the upper Mississippi River Basin, the Great Plains area, and you see over here in the Chesapeake Bay, this area over here in the Chesapeake Bay. Kind of the bigger the circle, the higher the concentration of nitrogen measured. And what we're seeing then in correlating the percentage of agriculture in the watershed versus the total nitrogen measured, we're seeing some of those areas. This area here is the Chesapeake Bay. This area here where there's a high percentage of agriculture in the watershed is that upper Mississippi River Basin area. Of note, the stream biology, poor stream biology is twice as likely in streams with high levels of nitrogen, phosphorus, and sediments. It seems pretty intuitive that would be the case, but we were able to correlate that with some of these this information, and you can see where we see poor, fair, and good stream biology conditions. Basically, the bottom line here with the sample sites, 32% of the stream length has high concentration of nitrates compared to that least disturbed reference condition. 31% has high concentration of phosphorus, 26% has a high level of riparian zone disturbance, and 25% has stream bed characterization in poor condition. Specifically in the Mississippi River Basin, talking about the streams, again, recognize that these are the wadable streams, these are those smaller streams running through ag fields, the forest, etc. You can kind of see where we have exceedances and non-exceedances. We didn't have enough data points in the lower Miss in the Tennessee River Basin to give statistically valid results there, so that's why we don't have that information. But you can kind of look across the board and see what's going on. The USGS Sparrow model, there's been quite a few reports come out over the last few years as they've developed this throughout the Mississippi River Basin that's given us a lot of information. We're seeing a greatest reduction in the load to the Gulf that would be predicted from targeting those sources near the large rivers or small streams that flow quickly to those large rivers. So we can take some of the information that we've learned from the wadable stream survey, and also I'll note that we have preliminary data on the lake survey that has been conducted over the last 2 years, and that will be published very soon. And I've seen some of that preliminary data, and it is correlating with some of the things that we're seeing here, which again, not that surprising. But from that point of the greatest load reduction, where are we going to get it? Is that where we need to focus on? Do we need to begin targeting better our programs, our projects, et cetera? Algal bloom occurrences, this is from the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute, where we're seeing the occurrences of algal blooms across the country. We recognize that this is largely caused by nutrient loads, nutrient impairments, et cetera, related impairments. And hypoxic zone locations. We talk in the press, there's a lot of talk about the Gulf of Mexico, northern Gulf of Mexico hypoxic zone. But of note, there are 168 hypoxic zones just in the United States in our coastal waters. Public health risks from drinking water. This is an incredibly costly piece, and this is where the economic piece really comes to light for those policymakers making decisions and looking at all those different, what was mentioned before, between the environmental, the social, and the economic indicators. And what you see here is nitrate exceedances. The red dots are exceedances, and maybe you can't really even see them on there. Exceedances over time. And the red dots are greater than 10 milligrams per liter. And so that would be an exceedance of a drinking water standard for nitrate. And you hear about specific instances, but this is a national problem that we need to be focusing on as well. What does it all come down to? The two previous talks here have kind of set this up pretty well. National population growth. It's accelerating at an exponential rate. And as population growth accelerates at an exponential rate, we can see nutrient pollution accelerating at an exponential rate. While the POTWs and the sewage treatment plants have done a number of controls, we still have to work in that area we recognize in getting new controls, new tertiary treatment into the mainstream of discussion there. So we also recognize that there are multiple sources. Nationally in scope, this is kind of a summary, 14,000 nutrient-related impairment listings in the 49 states, not including Hawaii. It's obviously an underestimate. This comes from that set of streams that are, in fact, looked at. There's a small subset of streams, lakes, and rivers that are looked at to make those impairment listings. And you can see that from this. This is our 2002 water quality, National Water Quality Report to Congress. And we do have more recent data, and I apologize, I couldn't grab it in enough time to present or to have it here, but we do have some of that information. The number one source for rivers and stream impairments, 94,000 miles 33% of the impaired miles are agricultural sources. The third source for lakes, ponds, and reservoirs, and the ninth source for estuaries, so those areas along the coastal areas, not directly adjacent many times to those agricultural fields, like the rivers, streams, and lakes and ponds in the rest of the country. So a few key facts that we're looking at, just the vast economic piece here that we have to recognize is included. Livestock production in the U.S. is a $130 billion industry. We recognize that we're looking at dealing with 1 billion tons of manure annually. That adds a huge twist in the question of how we do nutrient management well. And that's something that we really need to look at the full picture, across the board. What's the concentration within those tons? What are we doing with it? How are we treating it? How are we applying it on the land? It's that edge of field, infield, and ways to control it. Currently, with our new CAFO regulation that came out last year, there is a substantial portion of ag livestock production that is not regulated. So one question is, what does that mean for new regulations in the future? But also, what does that mean for our programs? What does that mean for our incentive-based and non-regulatory programs to get at some of those controls? Where does the accountability come in again? For ag row crops specifically, $120 billion industry. We recognize the economic importance. One of the big things that we are struggling with trying to develop new programs, regulatory tools, et cetera, is that stormwater runoff and irrigation return flows are specifically exempt from the Clean Water Act. So we don't have those types of controls that we can put in place in agriculture like we can, per se, industrial sources as well as POTWs, et cetera. That is a major area that we're looking at. How can we increase accountability through our existing tools and our existing authorities? And again, I'll just come back to mention that variable controls at the state level. So what do we need? We obviously, and I think that the gentleman who spoke before me made this point very well too, a profound change in course is needed. The idea that the voluntary approach alone are not working for non-point sources has been recognized for more than 20 years. The program that I work with was developed in the late 80s as a reauthorization of the Clean Water Act in 1988 to recognize that non-point sources were not being controlled at the rates, and they were increasing at the rates that the point sources were being controlled and decreasing. 30% compliance with the need to implement best management practices. What does that mean for us? What does that mean for the scientific community to develop means and ways to make sure that we have the right tools to get on the ground? What does it mean for the educational community, as the gentleman who spoke before me noted, to get that information out? And what does it mean for the policymakers to use all the tools that we have at in our toolkit to get to these reductions? One thing we specifically see with the TMDL process that is in authority from the Clean Water Act, those are generally focused on urban and suburban areas. Rural TMDLs are lagging. One of the reasons for that is because of that absence of nutrient water quality standards. Those are the impairments, nutrient-related impairments. That's where we're seeing some of those. And we don't have that TMDL program working in those areas. What can we do to change that? Barriers exist to sharing accountability between sources, within watersheds, and across state lines. This is a bottom line that we see from the national perspective, that we've got to find a way to develop something that allows those cross-boundary groups to work together for similar goals. And this is something that we're going to be focusing on as we look to build a new accountability structure. Some tools and authorities, I keep referring to tools and authorities, so what do I mean by that? They're fourfold, basically. Incentive-based, which are voluntary agreements, corporate stewardship, trading programs, non-regulatory programs would be or non-regulatory tools and authorities would be those volunteer monitoring, the states that are developing nutrient load reduction strategies, and then tracking and implementation plans. We have existing and alternative regulatory programs, which would be the point source caps, the CAFO regulation, NPDES permits, water quality standards, et cetera. And then we have anything that could come from new legislative action, which just last week, the Cardin bill, there was a bill introduced by Senator Cardin from Maryland that we're going to be looking at closely as that develops, because that could be a legislative change. Taking a look at our programs at EPA, what's partially utilized, what's underutilized? You kind of look across the board there and you say, where do nutrients play here? Where can we get at nutrient reductions by these tools that are possibly underutilized or partially utilized? And this is a question that we are focused on right now, and we are trying to determine how we can use these tools that we may not be using to their full authority to see real reductions in nutrients. So what is the tipping point? What's going to cause that profound change across the board? Is it more hypoxic zones? We have 168. More local water quality disasters, loss of safe sources of drinking water, fisheries collapse. So are we there now? Is it time for that profound change to happen? Hearing the gentleman that spoke before me, I think there's a lot more information that could make a case for that. So specifically talking about some upcoming actions that EPA is taking. One, we are looking to create a new accountability framework to guide federal and state actions. We're looking at a couple different opportunities for that. One would be through the TMDL program and that definition of reasonable assurance. What does that mean? How can someone writing a TMDL reasonably assure that the non-point sources will meet their load allocations in that TMDL? We're looking at new opportunities for CAFO regulations. They're threefold. First and foremost, expanding the existing regulated the universe of existing regulated operations to lower thresholds, setting new minimum performance standards for their permits, as well as looking at new requirements for that land application of manure. This is the biggest hole that we see in the CAFO regulation currently, is that off-site transport of manure, that those billions of tons that we see of manure, once they leave that production that has the permit, they are no longer permitted. They are no longer required to do a nutrient management plan unless the state has come in and required that, which has happened in some instances. So we've got to better understand how nutrient management can be a part of the CAFO regulation that we currently have in a broader sense. Looking at new and expanding sources of nutrients and or sediments, this would be an offset rule. So how can we ensure that any new or an expanding discharge currently permitted are offset by reductions from other sources at levels that account for that scientific uncertainty? This is a big question right now, and we are considering how we would write a national regulation for this. 502 guidance. This is technical guidance, and 502 comes from the Chesapeake Bay Executive Order, and all of these do. These are in the draft report that came out in September. There will be a next report and a strategy from all the federal agencies that are involved in the Chesapeake Bay federal leadership community. And Section 502 of the executive order calls for guidance, technical guidance, that links practice implementation and somehow to accountability. How can we do that? How can we bring those together? There has to be a situation that we can set up that can do that. But the 502 guidance is specifically technical guidance that we are developing. It will come out in May, and we're looking at it specifically as those next-gen tools. And I'm so excited to be here this week because I have a feeling I'm going to be learning a lot about what the next-gen tools in nutrient management are and how can we incorporate them into this document. So, a call to action, as I mentioned, that Nutrient Innovation Task Group. What will you do? First of all, what EPA can do. We've got to develop a better framework for accountability, but we need you all to help us do that. We must use the existing science and data to put these next generation tools on the ground faster. Questions for you to consider. How can ag sources of nutrients be held accountable for their contribution to the problem? And how do we tap into the scientific community to find the information that will feed national leadership to support and require consistent and full utilization of our existing authorities and tools? Questions for you to consider, and we'd love to have discussions and open that up. I don't know how much time I have left, but I'd love to take some questions if there are any.
Yeah, we have a couple.
Okay.
Urban and suburban nutrient non-source pollution, is that considered in with agriculture, or is that being looked at separately?
That's a great point, and I didn't incorporate all of the sectors that we're looking at. They are incorporated in non-point source pollution. Urban and suburban stormwater sources, we've got forestry sources, there are air deposition sources of nutrients. There are many sources. Ag is one of them. But ag is the leading non-point source, as we see it in our impaired lists.
But if you look at separately, then the urban and suburban is looked at separately from agriculture?
I hope I understand your question right, but we recognize that the tools to get at nutrient management and agriculture are a little bit different than the tools to get at urban and suburban sources. That 502 guidance is a cross-sector look. There's just one section on agricultural next-gen tools. The Chesapeake Bay regulations that I mentioned there are looking across sources, except really for that CAFO rule. There's also another regulation that I didn't include in here, which would be an urban stormwater regulation that we're looking at doing nationally as well. I think we could do something like that. You know, I mean, we can map geographically where estuaries are, and we could probably develop some indicators that would allow us to look at risk to all of the estuaries in the United States and then look at that. It's not something that I'm aware we've done. Okay, your hand was first back here.
Yeah, so just wondering about air quality. You didn't mention anything about that. I know EPA is involved.
The air side of things is moving along rapidly. We've got a number of things that we're looking at, not just for air deposition in agricultural as an agricultural source, but across the board. There's many air regulations that are under development right now. A lot of decisions being made linking to carbon and climate change, and I don't have all the information at hand to answer some of your questions, but I can certainly get back to you if you want to provide me a card. I can provide you with more specific information as our across-the-board actions that we're taking.
Is it integrated at all with the water, or is it separate?
It is integrated. We have a work group right now, and the air work group is, well, the air staff is certainly involved in looking at some of the possibilities for nutrient reductions from a CAFO source would be as we develop a new CAFO regulation. But that's just one, obviously, one source of nutrient deposition, nitrate deposition, from air sources. But it is integrated to the best that we can do with the data that we have.
Okay. Thank you so much, Katie.
Mm-hmm.